Hi there, I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. It's a podcast that turns up the volume with a lot of new ideas about how to help women succeed both at home and at work. We bring you conversations with brilliant women, women who have innovative and proven strategies to help you advance in your career and still stay balanced in your personal life. Did you know that the number one reason people leave their jobs today is because of their bosses? But the reality is we can't always leave a job because of a micromanaging, absentee, narcissistic, pushover, workaholic, or incompetent boss. So if you have a difficult boss, or you just want to know how to work more effectively with the boss you have, we have some good news for you. Our guest today is leadership expert Mary Abajay, author of Managing Up: How to Forge an Effective Relationship with Those Above You. Mary is interviewed here by Conferences for Women Communications Director Lisa Bennett.
So most leadership books out there focus on managing down the career ladder, if you will, but you say it's time to learn how to manage up. Why is that?
That's because, you know, no matter where you sit in an organization, you have a boss. If you're CEO of a public company, guess what? You have a board of directors to whom we answer to. And so at any given time, most of us are actually spending more time following than actually leading. We're spending more time implementing someone else's vision or the goals of other people as well as our own in the workplace. And you know, we spend so much time in America talking about leadership, 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 which is great. We all need to be leaders, but we also need to know how to be followers as well. And we need to be able to understand how to manage that relationship with the people who are above us in the food chain. So the other reason is if you want to be a good leader, and you want to learn how to manage down, you also need to learn how to manage up, because it's the same skills that you use up and down.
So that word about follower, I have to admit, for someone like me, that kind of sends shivers down my spine to think about being an effective follower. You know, I tend to be a little bit more individualistic. I think you have some qualms about that word follower yourself. How do we get over that? I mean, to focus on being effective, but not feel the negative connotation of being a follower.
I know, right? It makes me want to throw up a little bit in my mouth every time I say it, right? And people, they bristle at it, you know? And so I think in order to get over it, one of the things I like to say to people is, you want to reframe what followership is. First of all, it's not about blind followership. It's just not about, like, I'll do anything. It's not about being a yes man. I'll follow you to the end of the earth. It's about understanding, instead of looking at it as a power hierarchy, I want people to look at it as a relationship, right? And in a relationship, everybody has what we call agency. And if you are a quote-unquote a follower, if you are in a relationship where there is a power differential, you're still in the relationship. And that requires everybody playing a part. And understanding how to manage your end of the relationship is really important. And that, at the end of the day, is what managing up is. It's not about managing the person above you. It's about managing the relationship that you have with the people above you so that you can succeed, that they can succeed, and the organization can succeed. It's not about butt kissing. It's not about being a sycophant. It's not about blind followership. It's about understanding your role, taking an active part, being an active participant in that relationship.
That's really helpful. It depersonalizes it, you know, and conveys agency. I love what you just shared. I really want to dive into the strategies that you offer for dealing with all these particular kinds of difficult bosses. And I know our listeners want to hear that. But before we do, if we can just for a moment, talk about your journey to this work and why it became important to you. I noticed in particular that you dedicate your book to your dad, who I know was a nightclub owner. Can you tell us a little bit about how your relationship with him has affected this work that you do?
Yeah, so my dad, I love my dad. he died literally the week my book was due to the publisher. So, I mean, the book was really written. He was suffering from dementia. So the book was really written during the time I was going back and forth to Ohio every couple of weeks to be with him. He was a great guy. So just a little fun tidbit for your listeners is my dad owned this nightclub in Toledo, Ohio. That was a country music nightclub at one point. And that song, Lucille, that Kenny Rogers song in a bar in Toledo across from the depot, that was written in my dad's bar. So that is my dad's nightclub. So that's my little claim to fame on that one. So, you know, my dad was a first-generation American and, you know, grew up really poor and really taught me the value of agency, really of being responsible for your own life, about not being a victim, not complaining about what happened, but really making choices that are going to bring you what you want in the world. And that has stuck with me my entire life. Like with my dad, it was like, you kids, you make your own choices. You're the captains of your own ship. What happens in your life is a lot due to your agency. And so as I was doing this work on consulting, I started doing a lot, seeing a lot of people complain about their boss or about this or that. And I thought, you know what? You could get agency. This, you could be empowered. You don't have to be in that difficult situation. If you have a difficult boss, you could either just accept it and do what you can to survive it. You can change how you interact with that boss because you can't change the other person, or you can leave, like have agency. And so that's really what my dad taught me. And he was also just masterful at getting along with people. Everybody loved him.
Mm. So the way you talk about that, it almost makes it sound as if this whole challenge of, you know, or I don't want to say challenge, but the dynamic of managing the relationship with a boss, it almost sounds like a marriage, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's about trying to understand the other person, not change them, and applying the strategies, tapping into the strategies that work for that particular relationship.
That's exactly right. You know, because what happens in America and in most Western European countries is that you don't actually know who you're going to marry, right? In your metaphor, right? So bosses, people get promoted to managerialship because they're good at their job, right? So you're great at sales, let's make you head of sales. You're a great artist, let's make you in charge of the marketing department. You're a great coder, so you're in charge of IT. And so we promote people in America based on their ability to deliver the service or the product, not based on their ability to manage the people. So we're going to have, so your type of manager is going to be a crapshoot, right? Like some managers are going to be wonderful and great, and some are going to be okay. Some are going to be really kind of difficult, and some are going to be terrible. And so understanding that you're going to have the spectrum and understanding that people are who they are and they get rewarded for being who they are, that it's up to us to learn how to deal with these different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of dealing with the different kinds of people, one of the first steps you recommend is to figure out whether your boss is an introvert or an extrovert. Now, those are words that people often use, but I think there's also a little bit of misunderstanding about them. Can you help with an easy way to try to understand that? And then once you do understand it, what do you do with that information?
Yeah, that's great. So it's a three-step process. Look at who your boss is, understand how they operate, don't judge, understand how you operate, and then assess the gap. So I often start with introversion and extroversion because it's really kind of a basic human preference of interaction, and people don't understand that introversion and extroversion, often it's misunderstood. It's about source of energy. It's about what energizes people. And it also impacts how oftentimes we prefer to communicate. And so with that, you want to know if your boss leans heavily one way or the other, you want to make sure that you are not de-energizing them. You want to make sure you understand their communication preferences. So for example, an introvert is someone that's going to be energized from within. So an introvert and is going to have what we call a lower threshold for external stimulus. An external stimulus is usually other people. So if you have an introverted boss, right, that boss is probably not running around the office saying, how you doing? How you doing? Like they're not popping in to say hello to you. They're probably not sharing a ton of information. They're probably forgetting to tell you stuff. They're definitely not reaching out to check in on you. They may be working in their office with the door closed. And in fact, they may be sitting in the same room as you and email you instead of just speaking to you. And so it's important to understand
Guilty.
That, right? Guilty. Yeah, I'm an introvert too. I do that all the time. If I don't have to talk to my staff, I'll text them. Now, an extroverted boss is the opposite. So extroverts get energized from the outside world, from people, from ideas, from activity. They have what we call a higher threshold for external stimulus. So they probably are walking around the office. They probably are saying, how are you doing? They're probably checking in. They're probably holding lots of meetings. They're probably brainstorming out loud and popping into your office and, you know, doing teamwork together and things like that. And so you need to understand how to work with that boss as well, because those you want to interact really differently with those two types of bosses.
Given that as a foundation,
yeah,
you have a wide array of different kinds of bosses in your wonderful book. Some of them are good bosses, but we don't really want to talk about them.
They're so, no fun to talk about.
So we're focusing in on the difficult ones. You've been doing this work. You've been led so many workshops on this for quite some time. Tell us about everyone's favorite difficult boss.
Number one, favorite difficult boss, the most dreaded, the most hated, the most like, ugh, is the, drum roll please, is the micromanager. Like, everybody bristles at the micromanager. And, you know, I find that really interesting for a couple reasons. One, I think micromanaging is often in the eyes of the beholder or the beholdee, right? What feels like micromanaging to one person may not feel like micromanaging to another person. And the other reason I find that interesting is because if you do any research in the neuroscience, so like the David Rock stuff, so human beings have neuropsychological needs for a couple of five things, but two of them, one of them, I'll talk about two of them. The first one is we have a neuropsychological need for something called autonomy, which is to have our own agency, to be able to be independent, to be able to work on our own, to be able to use our own thoughts and ideas to move forward. And then the another really big neuropsychological need is the need for certainty, right? To know how things are going to turn out, to understand what the process is, to be certain of outcomes, right? And so what happens is when our need for autonomy rubs up against our bosses, overly stretched need for certainty, it's going to feel like micromanaging. But the good news is, right, because they want to know more about, they want more involvement, and we want more independence. So the good thing to know about micromanagers is that they're actually one of the easiest people to manage up to. You just need to understand that they want a little bit more information, a little bit more control, and a little bit more inclusion. They need a little more certainty than we are willing to offer to give. And most of the time, when you give them that, they will loosen the reins. So I always say to people, here are my top three strategies for working with a micromanager. Number one, don't take it personally. Don't get all resistant. Don't get all huffy. Unless you're the only person that's being micromanaged. And then I say you need to take it very personally. And what I mean by that is if you're the only one being micromanaged, you have to figure out why. There's something that you are not doing, giving, providing to that manager that makes them feel that they need to micromanage you. So you want to find out. So tip number one is find out what it is they want. They might want something in a very specific way. Don't resist it. Find out. Try to do it. The second thing is you want to flood them with information. You want to tell them stuff before they ask. I had a micromanager boss once, and I literally gave her an email twice a day about all my tasks. And after that, I slowly kind of stopped doing it. Within like 6 weeks, I had all the autonomy I wanted because she felt very certain that I was working on the things that she wants to work on. And my last tip for working with a micromanager is really be clear about what their expectations are. Like, what does success look like? So if they give you a project, you know, be a little proactive finding out what they really want, and just gonna require asking a lot of questions.
So very interesting. And what you said is that by not fighting their need for certainty, but delivering on it, you get what you actually want, which is the autonomy.
You just summed that up so beautifully. Yes, that's exactly right, Lisa.
Okay, great. Okay, there are so many other different types of difficult bosses. I want to see if we can hit on as many as possible for folks who deal with all these different kinds of personalities. So let me name some of the types and then ask you to quickly share your best insights and strategies. Okay, a boss who publicly belittles or demeans you.
Oh, so that's a tough one. So with a boss like that, someone who's going to publicly humiliate or demean you, what I would recommend is really figure out like how bad they do it. A boss like that, I would say, I think you need to quit, quite honestly. And you might, when they publicly demean you, you might stick up for yourself. You might laugh it off. You might have a private conversation. But a boss that does that, to me, is a broken person. So if I had a boss like that, quite frankly, I'd look for other opportunities.
Okay. The workaholic.
The workaholic is easy peasy lemon squeezy. You want to be clear about their requests and your boundaries. So what I mean by their requests is if they're emailing you on the weekends or they're, you know, texting you at night or whatever, you need to be clear that they actually mean for you to answer. Because some workaholics are just emailing when they're cleaning off their own desk. So be clear about that. Also be clear about your boundaries, when you are willing to work and when you're not willing to work. And you want to do that with some tact, but let them know your true availability. The other thing I want you to do is always, you have to always bring your A game every day with a workaholic. If you can show them output, 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 show them how much you're doing, they'll probably won't expect you to do a lot on the weekends. And then finally, with a workaholic, I hate to, I'm going to tell you, because I'm a workaholic, we all tell you like, oh no, we don't want you to work on weekends. You don't need to. But when you do once in a while, we're going to love you just a little bit more. So you just get to choose. And you should always know, by the way, before you work for a workaholic, you should find out whether or not they are one. Because we wear it as a badge of honor. And if that's not your cup of tea, then don't work for one. At the end of the day, right?
Being clear, that's very clear. Yeah.
I mean, don't you, every workaholic you know, Lisa, pretty much claims it as a badge of honor, right?
Absolutely.
So you
absolutely
need to find out. Yep. You need to find out.
How about the nitpicker?
I love the nitpicker. So the nitpicker, I love the nitpicker. So the nitpicker, all micromanagers are nitpickers, but not all nitpickers are micromanagers. Because sometimes a boss might give you a project and then like leave you alone. And then when you turn it in, they nitpick, nitpick, nitpick. So with the nitpicker, you want to really find out what, again, don't resist it. Find out what it is they really care about. Find out ahead of time. You know, if they like the Oxford comma and you don't, well, use the Oxford comma. If they like a certain font, use a certain font. And so with that, you just kind of have to like say, you know, because they're going to change it back and forth 1,000 times. But really, find out first what it is. Try and dive down about what their preferences are, because there's usually something driving that preference. And if you can learn what it is, you can resolve some of the nitpicking.
You know, it's interesting as you offer, you know, really clear strategies for all these different kinds of characteristics. I sense underneath like this mindset, which is just what works with this person. Don't let it trigger you, right?
That's exactly right. What works with this person? And I don't ever want anyone to do anything unethical, anything untoward. It's not about sucking up, but I really look at people like a puzzle, and I really start figuring out what's going to work with this person. And what am I willing to do differently, more of or less of at the end of the day? Like maybe I'm not willing to use the Oxford comma. And if I'm not willing to use the Oxford comma with a boss that likes the Oxford comma, then at least I am choosing that, and then I'm going to have to choose a different job, right? Because I know that that's not going to work. So it's also about trying more than one thing. Right. And people are not one thing. Right. So you might have, my team calls me the introverted workaholic ghost boss, sometimes nitpicker. Right. So it's about understanding, you know, that people are complex, but always trying to find strategies that make that work.
So we've looked a little bit about, you know, the boss who's got a lot of control issues as one of the things that drives people most crazy, right? What about kind of the other end of the spectrum in a couple of regards? One is the one who's a little bit checked out or just doing their own thing, or the one who's impulsive and kind of swings from this idea to that idea.
Yeah, so let's do the checked out one. We call this the ghost boss. So ghost bosses can be really empowering for some people, like people that don't like any control. Like having a ghost boss can be, you know, the best thing ever because you can run your own show. But it can also be very frustrating if you actually need some direction. So the ghost boss, you're going to want to have to be proactive about getting their time. You have to be very clear and very specific about what you need. It's going to be up to you to be proactive about getting on their calendar and reviewing projects. And they're going to cancel half your meetings, so you have to just ask for more than you need. And you're probably going to have to turn to colleagues for a little bit of mentoring and growth. And you're going to have to figure stuff out on your own. So it's going to take a lot of self-initiative if you work for a ghost boss, but there's a lot of potential and power with the ghost boss. If you hold it that way.
Right.
With the impulsive, that's the boss that's, you know, as you said, like always shifting sands. One day is one priority, one day is another. What you want to do with that boss, if possible, just a couple ideas is, you know, first of all, try to embrace a grain of what they're trying to do, because oftentimes the impulsive is actually trying to do something new and different and creative. You know, you want to kind of assume positive intention. So you want to offer them pros and cons of the new ideas, like, oh, I love that idea, and use the word and with them. And here's some of the challenge you will have with that. Offer them project lists and say, oh, love that idea, and don't say love the idea, but say, and where would this fall on the other list of priorities that we have, or what resources do you want to take from something onto this? So you want to like really kind of bring them down a little bit, but you want to let them like go wow, wow, wow for a while, and then bring them down and then have them prioritize.
This, I have to say, this is like magic. There, you know, these are complex dynamics, and you've got boom, boom, boom. Here's what you do. This is great. How about the boss who, you know, you've been working on a project for 3 months, you almost completed it, you know, he or she swoops in, throws it in a whole different direction, right, and then leaves.
Yeah, so that's the seagull boss. So seagull bosses are either going to poop, I mean, they're either going to swoop and poop, or they're going to swoop and scoop, take it away. So the ones that are going to, some are going to swoop and like, just like, say it's awful. They're just going to like poop all over your project. So with that, you just got to be like, give a big sigh and then move on. Do not let it get you down. But sometimes your boss is going to take the project away. And there's not a lot you can do about it at the time. But what I'd like you to do, if your boss has a habit of that, is pay attention to what kind of projects that boss swoops and takes. Oftentimes, you'll find the swoopers, when the project suddenly becomes high profile, then the boss may want to get more involved in it. So kind of see if there's a pattern. And if you find a pattern of the kinds of projects your boss swoops on, then I would suggest really getting them, trying to get them involved earlier so that they don't swoop and take it away. So they feel that they have some interest in it. And sometimes they'll be like, oh, I don't want to do that. You take care of it. But if you can kind of sense what they're going to do, I would try and get their involvement earlier.
So smart. Here's one. We have a lot of listeners who work in tech. There are a lot of very young people in leadership positions. Any advice for folks dealing with a boss that's significantly younger than them?
You know, I love that one. And in tech, you have the other challenge of, you know, you have a lot of people who are very technically good, a lot of engineers, but mm-hmm. haven't really necessarily done a lot of the soft skills training, so that can be a double whammy. So I love this topic. So I'm going to have a couple of suggestions, but this is something I'm actually going to invite your listeners to give me some of their ideas, because I really want to start writing more about this. It's going to probably be in book two. So I think, first of all, if your boss is younger than you, you need to give them a chance. I want you to watch your assumptions. Like, we watch assumptions that person is younger, they don't know what they're doing. Like, you need to take that down a notch. The other thing is you want to see, you want to be open to their ideas. You know, they're going to maybe suggest things that you've already tried and it didn't work. Well, maybe it didn't work 10 years ago. Maybe there's a new way of trying. So I want you to be open to change, open to trying things. You want to come across as the person that may be a little bit more mature, a little bit more senior, a little bit more experienced, and you're going to give that experience to help them be successful. So my biggest thing is do not judge that person for their youth. Instead, see how you can help them succeed by using your experience and your wisdom to make them successful. And then ultimately, you'll be successful.
That's another one of your threads, isn't it? Do not judge.
Do not judge. Because the minute we judge, yeah. Lisa, the minute we judge, we usually judge negatively. Like, oh, you're different mm-hmm. than me, so you're, you know, I. And what happens when we judge, and then when we complain, we turn ourselves into victims. And the thing I really want people to get out of this book is, I don't want you to be a victim. It's okay to judge and be like, this isn't for me, so I'm going to leave. What's not okay for you is say, this sucks, and I'm just going to sit here and complain and let my career die in the vine. That's being a victim. I want people to be career victors and not career victims. It really mm-hmm. is about empowerment.
I absolutely hear that. We are coming to the end of our time, so I can't not ask about this last one before we begin to wrap up. You described the truly terrible boss as the psycho, crazy, bully, tyrannical, screaming egomaniac.
Yeah.
To that point, how do you know when it is simply time to quit?
That is
the empowering thing.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, when you start feeling like physically ill, emotionally drained, if your stomach is a knot every time you go to work, if your boss is demeaning, devaluing, if your people, if everyone you know and love says, what the hell are you thinking? You need to get out of there. If your boss is toxic, you have to quit. And working for toxic bosses is actually emotionally and physically and psychologically damaging. You have something like 60% greater chance of heart disease and stroke. You're going to have like your immune system drops, like it is bad news. So do not think that that boss is going to suddenly turn into a good person. Do not think that HR is coming to save you, because chances are they're not. And do not think that just because you've worked there for 2 years, that if you leave now, you're going to lose what you've put in there. You need to quit. Nobody should ever work for someone that devalues them and demeans them. It is wrong. You just have to quit.
Wrapping up here, your book has so much in it that we haven't been able to get to. So I really encourage anybody who's dealing with any kind of type of boss that we haven't gotten to look at it. It is the Bible on this topic. You've been an expert in human dynamics within organizations for some time. If you could magically leave everyone with one bottom line insight that could make our working lives better, what would that be?
I'd say talk to people, appreciate people, and at the end of the day, it's about adapting. Like, how can you be adaptive and flexible to the different people, the different circumstances, the different environment, the different work you can be? The more adaptable and flexible you can be, the more of that skill set you build, managing up, managing down, managing cross, the more successful you'll be.
That's Mary Abajay. In addition to her company CareerStone, Mary has served as adjunct faculty at George Mason University's School of Management and has taught at both Montgomery College and the Georgetown University Center for Professional Development. Her work and advice have appeared in many reputable sources, including the New York Times and the Harvard Business Review. If you enjoyed this conversation, I hope you'll subscribe and also share it with a friend or a coworker. Leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. That helps other people find us. And be sure to check out all the offerings from the Conferences for Women. There may be one near you, since the Conferences for Women draws more than 45,000 people to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and Silicon Valley. For now, I'm Celeste Headley. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thanks for listening. Be kind and be well.